So this is lecture two of Standard Model and Beyond. So let's see. So the main point of today will be that, you know, the Standard Model is a gauge theory, and it's a particular kind of gauge theory, namely a Yang-Mills theory. And so I want to introduce, we want to do a lightning introduction slash review, depending on what your background is, of what Yang-Mills theory is. But before that, I thought I ran out of time at the end of the previous lecture, and at the time I thought I would abandon the thing I wanted to say during the final 5 or 10 minutes, but now I think that's a bad idea. So I was just going to take the first 5 or 10 minutes to finish the story from the last lecture, just to get to, you know, what I think is an important punchline. Okay, so to quickly recap, you know, so last time we met reviewed two basic types of objects that will be important during the course, namely algebras. We said those are just vector spaces equipped with an additional property that you can take a bilinear product of two vectors to get another vector. And in particular, we met two important examples of algebras, the normed division algebras, of which there are four, the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions, and the octonions, and then Lie algebras. And we saw that these give, in a sense, the nicest way to understand the classification of these guys. Namely, there's a very, once you've introduced the four norm division algebras, there's a very simple way to state the classification of the Lie algebras, which is that, so Lie algebras are just, we said, were just special kinds of algebras where the product had two extra properties. It was anti-symmetric, and it satisfied the Jacobi identity. And then they've been classified. The simple Lie algebras have been classified. And they come in three infinite families. There's SON, the special orthogonal Lie algebras. We said those were the set of n by n matrices with, these were the set of n by n real matrices, which were anti-Hermitian, x dagger is equal to minus x, and traceless. Then there's SUN, the special unitary Lie algebra. That's exactly the same thing. It's the set of matrices x, but now they are complex n by n matrices. But again, everything else is the same. They're anti-Hermitian and they're traceless. And then there are the symplectic Lie algebras of order n. And again, it's the same story. These are the set of n by n quaternionic matrices. And again, they are anti-Hermitian. But now in this case, we don't have the trace condition. Okay, so that was one thing. And then the other thing is, the other guys we met were groups. So the other objects we met were groups. And again, there was a general definition of groups that they're just a set of objects where you can multiply two objects to get another element in the set. And that product has three properties. There's an identity element, it's associative, and every element has an inverse. But in particular, in this course, when we're dealing with gauge theories and Yang-Mills theories, the most interesting groups to us will be Lie groups. So those are groups where the set of elements is a continuously infinite set, so it can be described by a manifold. And every point on the manifold is actually an element of the group, and you can multiply this point times this point to get a third point on the manifold. And in particular, there's some point on the manifold which is the identity element in the group, and the tangent space near that point is nothing but a Lie algebra. And going in the other direction, if we exponentiate the Lie algebras, that's how we get the Lie groups. And so there's a completely analogous classification of Lie algebras. But I realized I forgot to mention the last line here and the Lie algebras thing. Sorry about that. So these are the classical Lie algebras, and then there are five exceptional cases: G2, F4, E6, E7, and E8. And again, we said those. You might think from this pattern that those are related, those exceptional cases are related to the Octonians, and indeed they are. They're related to the Octonians in a way that I won't explain now, but we'll explain later in the course by something called the magic square. Very beautiful construction. Okay, so then for the Lie groups, there's a very closely analogous classification. Now there's capital SON, the special orthogonal group. And that is the group of, now, that we get by exponentiating those things. So those are the n by n real matrices that are, if you exponentiate that first condition, it says that G dagger is equal to G inverse, or in other words, G in the real case, this says G transpose is equal to G inverse. That's what an orthogonal matrix is, and has determinant 1. And then similarly, SUN would be the case where we have n by n complex matrices that are unitary, in the sense that G dagger is equal to G inverse and have determinant 1. And in the symplectic case, they are n by n quaternionic matrices that are unitary in the same sense. Now we drop the determinant condition. And finally, we have the exceptional Lie algebras, which are just these guys, but now with capital letters. Sorry, the exceptional groups, which are these guys, but now with capital letters, and that are just, again, obtained by the magic square, and then exponentiating those Lie algebras. Okay, so what I wanted to then briefly say was to give a couple, just a brief nod to some of the other parts of mathematics that are sort of neatly organized in this way using the norm division algebras, because then there will be a point I want to make about that. So let's next talk about the classification of manifolds by their holonomy groups. Okay, so here there's a famous theorem. If we look at Riemannian manifolds, so suppose we look at some Riemannian manifold. Okay, so these are the sorts of manifolds you're meeting in Ruth's course on gravitational physics. Except here I'll be focusing, of course, she's considering space-time manifolds where the metric has one, has signature 1, 3. There's one minus sign in the signature and three plus signs. So there's a time-like direction and three space-like directions. So, but this theorem actually applies to the Euclidean case where there's four space-like directions. So everything is plus. Okay, so, but anyway, we consider such a manifold, and now, So we have vectors in a tangent space at some point. And now, if we consider, now we can parallel transport these vectors, and in particular, we can consider parallel transporting them around some closed curve that starts at that point and comes back to the same point. And when we take this vector, let's say, for a ride around this closed curve, parallel transport it using the covariant derivative, then in general, when we get back, the vector at the end of the parallel transport will be different than the one that we started with. That difference, that fact that the end curve comes back differently, that the end vector is different than the starting vector, is called holonomy. So now, in particular, we can take every vector in this vector space and parallel transport it. And every vector comes back to some new vector. And parallel transport is a linear operation. So what's happening here is when we take this curve is defining a map from this vector space into itself. We take any vector in the vector space, and it gets mapped by carrying it around this loop back into itself. Now, parallel transport preserves the length of the vector. So it'll come back and it'll have the same length, but it'll be pointing in a different direction. So that's telling us that the linear map from this vector space to itself, if we're looking at an n-dimensional manifold, some n-dimensional real manifold, we expect that map to be an element of On. And now, as we change the curve, if now we switch and we take a different curve, let's say this one, we'll get a different element of On. And this one will give yet another element of On. So as we fix the point, but then take all the different possible closed curves we can, we get a set of different elements of the group On, the set of orthogonal n by n matrices. And in general, for a general manifold, we'll get all the elements of On, or I should say, really for an orientable manifold, we'll get all the elements of SON. We'll only get the determinant equals plus one matrices. We'll get half of the elements of On, let's say. But for more special manifolds, we'll get only special subgroups of this. And so there's a famous theorem about what you get. Okay, so let's say this is the dimension of the manifold here. Okay. This is first, I'm going to make a little table here. This is the dimension of the manifold. And then here's the group you get, so-called holonomy group. Okay, and then these various cases have names. Okay, so if you just consider a general n-dimensional manifold, as we were saying before, if it's an n-dimensional orientable manifold, then we'll get all possible positive determinant elements of On. But then, okay, and that's just a real orientable manifold. But then, if we consider a 2n-dimensional manifold, an even-dimensional manifold, then something special can happen, which is that we can find that instead of getting the full group we would expect, SO2n, the holonomies, as we vary the curve over there, can wind up only lying in a subgroup, which is un. Okay? So if the holonomy ends up being un, and that's a special kind of even-dimensional manifold called a Kähler manifold. And then in even dimensions, something even more special can happen, which is that the holonomies could end up lying in even a subgroup of this, namely SUN, the determinant 1 unitary matrices. And that manifold is a so-called Calabi-Yau manifold. Okay. But now if the manifold is not only an even dimensional manifold, but actually a multiple of 4 dimensional, then something even more special can happen, which is that instead of getting SO4N, or even the subgroup SU2N, which is what we would have gotten at this level of specialness, we get even yet a subgroup of that, which is the symplectic group of order N times the symplectic group of order 1, which is really just SU2, it turns out, anyway. Details are not important, but so then these are called quaternionic Kähler manifolds. And okay, almost there. So a 4N dimensional manifold can have something even more special that happens, which is that the holonomy can lie in an even smaller subgroup, which is just SPN. These are called hyperkähler. And then there's two more cases. There's two special cases. If the manifold has 7 dimensions, then the holonomy group could end up being just the exceptional group G2, which turns out to be nothing but the automorphism group of the octonions, and that's a so-called G2 manifold. And finally, the last case is if you have a dimension 8 manifold, not 8n, just 8, then this could end up being the group spin 8. And then that's a so-called spin 8 manifold. Sorry, spin 7. That's a so-called spin 7 manifold. Okay, now I mention this for two reasons. Well, in view of time, I mention this for one reason. So this is another apparently quite different area of mathematics, but we see that it's again classified, that there's a couple of infinite families of sort of normal cases. This one is related to the reals. This is really saying the manifold is fundamentally a real manifold. But here, we had an even dimensional real manifold, but what's really going on here is that this is telling you that these are secretly, instead of 2n dimensional real manifolds, they're really n dimensional complex manifolds. These two cases, instead of being 4n dimensional real manifolds, there's a more natural interpretation of these guys as n dimensional quaternionic manifolds. And then, as in the previous cases, we had a few infinite families, which were the normal cases and corresponded to the first three norm division algebras. And then we had a finite number of leftover cases, which were related to the octonions, and that is also the case here. These are really saying that these manifolds are in some sense coordinatized by the octonions, or by the 7 imaginary octonions in this case. Okay, and really, there's a whole bunch of apparently unrelated things that all end up repeating this story. So there's the classification of regular polytopes. So these are like regular, you know, so in 3 dimensions, for example, the regular polytopes are the 5 Platonic solids. So there's the, let's say the tetrahedron, okay, which I'll try to draw, and then the cube. And the octahedron, I mean, yeah, in the octahedron. Okay, but then there's two fancier cases in three dimensions. There's the icosahedron, which is this 20-sided figure. Where the sides are all equilateral triangles. And then there's the dodecahedron, which I'm going to I'm just drawing it because otherwise, well, I want there to be some picture that sticks in your mind. So they get less regular as they go along, and my drawing skills fail. But so there's five of these guys in three dimensions. But now, if we consider in four dimensions, it turns out there's six. There's the analogs of these three, and then there's the analogs of these two, and then there's one more. This is the 3D case here. This is the 4D case here. But then beyond 4D, in five dimensions and higher, now there's only three. There's only the analogs of this one, and this one. So in any dimension you continue to have, in 5D, 6D, et cetera, you always have the analog of the tetrahedron, the analog of the cube, and the analog of the dual of the cube, which is the so-called cross polytope, right? Basically the generalization of this octahedron. So you have these three infinite families, which are sort of the regular cases again, and then you have this handful of special cases, the icosahedron, the dodecahedron, and then the three special shapes in four dimensions. And once again, really secretly, this is about the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions, and then the special cases have to do with the Ectonians. Another case like this is, it happens again and again. In the classification, another kind of algebra, which we haven't met yet, are the Jordan algebras. We'll meet these later. These are the algebras of observables in quantum mechanics, but then, as realized by a Bulgarian guy last year, as I've become more convinced of recently, these things also have to do with the standard model. So we'll meet these later. The classification of these was done by Wigner and von Neumann, and falls into a series of normal families that have to do with R, C, and H, and then one special case, which is the 3x3 octonionic matrices. My point is that the pattern repeats again and again. Mathematics has turned out over the 20th century, especially over the 20th century, to be unified in many unexpected ways. Many seemingly different branches of mathematics turn out to be intimately related to one another. And a theme which has emerged is that in many different areas, there's this pattern, which is that when you classify the objects in that area, there are sort of the normal cases, which in some sense, in some way or another, relate to these guys. And then there are a handful of special cases which relate to the Octonians. And so it's as if there is kind of this normal part of mathematics, and then there's this kind of leftover exceptional part. And, you know, I think it's worth thinking about when we're looking at the standard model and ideas about physics beyond the standard model, is the mathematics that explains where the standard model comes from, is the mathematics relevant for the fundamental laws of nature or our universe? Is it drawn from the normal part of mathematics, or is it drawn from somehow the exceptional part? And it's an interesting story. There's kind of hints in both directions, and I'll try to be explaining that more over the course of the course. But I must say that I I recently have become much more confident that it's related to the exceptional part. And so that's one of the things that I'll talk about right at the very end of the second half of the course. Okay. Well, maybe now is a good time to break to go to the other board. Okay. So I took longer than I had intended. But so now, the standard model is a Yang-Mills theory. It's a particular kind of Yang-Mills theory. And Yang-Mills theory is a particular kind of gauge theory. So, what we want to do is learn how to write down the action for the standard model. And so what we'll start is by writing down the action for a gauge theory, and then the simplest gauge theory, which hopefully will be a review. And then we'll see how to generalize that to write down the action for a Yang-Mills theory. And then in tomorrow's lecture, we'll be ready to write down the actual honest-to-God Lagrangian for the standard model itself. Okay, so wait, is now a good time to pause, or should we wait? Are you sufficiently exhausted yet that you need a pause, or should we wait? Okay, let's give it 10. What's the feeling? Give it 10 minutes or now?
We can give it 10 minutes.
Okay, give it 10 minutes. Yeah. Okay, so consider two simple Lagrangians, which hopefully you've already met. So there's the Lagrangian for just a free massive scalar field. Here I'll consider let's look at a complex scalar field. So that would be like this. It would have a kinetic term. And then if we want, we can also add a mass term. Okay. And then there's the corresponding Lagrangian for a free massive fermion, the Dirac Lagrangian. So again, there's a kinetic term. And a mass term. Okay, we're here. This notation, which maybe you've met, but just in case, is a slash means that I've taken some object with an index, in this case the partial derivative, partial sub mu, and contracted it with the Dirac gamma matrix. Let me first ask, this notation, familiar or not familiar? And this one? Yes? Okay, so so these Lagrangians, as they stand, both have a global symmetry. They have a global U1 symmetry. In the sense that if I take phi to e to the I alpha times phi, where alpha is just a constant, independent of the space-time position of the field phi, then this Lagrangian is invariant, because from this term I would pick up, since I'm taking the dagger, I get, when I substitute that, I get an e to the minus I alpha here, but I get an e to the I alpha from this guy, so they cancel. And similarly here, I get an e to the I alpha when I substitute here, and an e to the minus I alpha when I substitute here, and they cancel. And then there's a similar thing down here. Okay, so both of these theories have a global U1 symmetry, but when we talk about a gauge theory, a gauge theory is a theory where it has some local symmetry. And so what if we tried to make this a local symmetry? In other words, what if we tried to make it so that now when we send the field phi of x to something else, that something else depends on the space-time position x. Okay, well, now if we look at the derivative of phi, how does it transform? Well, it no longer transforms the way it did before because, well, we know how phi transforms, so it goes to e to the I alpha phi. And now, if this had been a global phase, if this had been a global transformation, so this did not depend on x, this would pass right through the derivative, and we would get e to the I alpha d mu phi, which is just what we got before, and we would plug that in here and find that this term was invariant. But now, because we're supposing that alpha does depend on x, now we get an extra term from the derivative acting on this guy. And that screws everything up. So that Lagrangian is no longer invariant. And similarly, here, if we tried to take psi to e to the I alpha psi, we would, if we let alpha depend on x, we would run into exactly the same problem. This would no longer be invariant. So these Lagrangians both have a global U1 symmetry, but they do not yet have a local U1 symmetry. They're not yet gauge theories. Okay, so there's a famous trick, which hopefully you've seen, for how to turn a theory with a global symmetry into a theory with a local symmetry, which is that you take the derivative, you replace the partial derivative by an appropriate covariant derivative. So you modify the derivative by adding a connection term, just like, hopefully, you've seen done in general relativity to make the derivative covariant there. Okay, and the idea now is that we want to demand, we don't yet know what we've added, we don't yet know how it should behave, but we can figure that out by demanding that this quantity, you know, we just saw that this quantity, we wanted it to transform like this, we wanted it to just pick up an overall e to the I alpha in front, but it didn't, okay? But now we'll demand that the covariant derivative does transform that way. So we're going to demand that when we make the transformation, we get d mu, so we go to d mu prime times phi prime, that is equal to just the overall e to the I alpha d mu phi times the untransformed thing. Okay, but then we can expand this out. We know this is d mu plus I. Oh, you know what? As a, okay, that's fine. So, okay, so d prime is d mu plus ig a prime, and then phi prime is e to the I alpha phi. So that's the left-hand side, and then the right-hand side is what it is, e to the I alpha times d mu is partial mu plus ig a mu times phi. Okay, we want these two sides to be equal, so let's look at them for a second. So this partial mu, again, when it acts on this, will produce two terms. On the one hand, it'll produce the term where it passes right through this e to the I alpha and hits partial. But that is exactly the same as the first term on the right-hand side. So those two terms will cancel. The first term from the Leibniz rule applied to this will cancel this term, if you see. So all we'll get from applying this guy over here is the other term, the term where partial mu acts on e to the I alpha. Okay, and then we get this term. And then on this side, this term has already canceled, so we're left with a to the I alpha ig a mu phi. So equating these both sides and solving for a mu prime, it's a simple bit of algebra to see that a mu prime, in order for those two sides to be equal, a mu prime must equal a mu, and then minus 1 over g b mu alpha. That's a little, let's leave that as an exercise to check if you've never checked that sort of thing. But so in other words, to summarize, if we want to make our theory from a global U1 theory to a theory with a local U1 symmetry, in other words, a U1 gauge theory, we replace the partial derivative by the covariant derivative, and we require that the connection that we've added, the A mu, transforms like this, and then we're in the clear. Okay, so then we get a gauge theory. So just to bring this board back for a moment. So in other words, if I just come in here and change this to this, and this to this, and this to this. So where d slash again is by the same notation, gamma mu contracted with the covariant derivative, then voila, these things are gauge theories. Now, there's one more thing to say. They're not quite the gauge theories we usually consider, because we have not yet written down, we've added this new field A mu, but we haven't yet written down a kinetic term for it. Now, strictly speaking, nothing, logic does not demand that we have to write down a kinetic term for it, but in the actual physical theories seen in the world, it does appear to be an independent degree of freedom. Actually, that's a whole interesting separate question, but in any case, in the standard model, as you usually write it down, this thing certainly is an independent degree of freedom. So how can we write down a kinetic term for this? Well, in this case, we can just notice that, well, you know, this guy does not transform nicely like a tensor yet. We're used to, if we want to build theories that are, just like in GR, if we want to build theories that are invariant under some transformation law, we want to find ingredients that transform simply under that transformation law so we can just multiply them together in the appropriate way to get something with no indices left over, no transformation properties left over, something that's invariant. Now this guy is not yet the thing we want. It doesn't transform like a tensor because there's this extra inhomogeneous piece occurring here. So, but of course, famously, as you probably know, if you build the field strength from this guy by this formula, then this thing is invariant. This thing just goes to itself. So now we can build, now all we have left over, now the only things we need to get rid of are these hanging Lorentz indices, because this thing is not yet invariant under Lorentz transformations. So, but we can contract it with itself. That gives us a non-zero quantity that is invariant under both space-time symmetries and under our local U1 symmetry. And this is the so-called Maxwell action. This is the action for the electromagnetic field. And so now, if we go over here, and we just add that term to both of these Lagrangians, okay, now we have ourselves an honest-to-God gauge theory. These are two very famous gauge theories. This one is the Lagrangian for QED, quantum electrodynamics. And this one is also quantum electrodynamics, but usually when you talk about quantum electrodynamics without any modifier, you mean it's the theory of the electromagnetic field coupling to fermions. This one, where the electromagnetic field couples to a scalar field, is usually specified by calling it scalar QED, scalar quantum electrodynamics. Okay, great. So that's the simplest example of a gauge theory, QED. QED, by the way, in modern lingo, just become equivalent to the theory of a U1 gauge theory. A gauge theory where the symmetry, the internal symmetry group, is this group U1. Okay, so then, fine. What is So now how do we get from there to Yang-Mills theory? Well, Yang-Mills theory is where we replace the symmetry group G. Previously we had U1, and that has the special property that it's an abelian group. And so the gauge theory based on it is called an abelian gauge theory. Abelian, again, means that the multiplication law is commutative here. So the elements of this group are just complex phases, e to the I alpha and e to the I beta. And of course, when you have two complex phases, it doesn't matter what order you multiply them in. That's the same as e to the I beta times e to the I alpha. And so that's what I mean when I say that the group is abelian or commutative. And you get a particularly simple gauge theory that way. And an important discovery by Yang and Mills was how to generalize that gauge theory to the case where G is some other group. Okay, let's take, because it's the group that's going to be relevant for the standard model, let's consider the group SUN. Anyway, this could really be any of the large number of other groups which are not abelian. So in other words, this is a group where, now these are n by n unitary matrices. In general, if I take two unitary matrices and I multiply them first in this order, that's not the same as multiplying those n by n unitary matrices in the other order. So this is a non-abelian group. And so we're going to have to think a little bit harder about how to write down this theory, but not much. But before we do, now, may I pause for a mid-class break? Okay, so I've decided I will, I know a lot of people are going to volunteer, and I'll just randomly choose, you know, I'll just draw a number from a hat in terms of who actually wants to do the performing. Okay, so nobody wants to do it. So in that case, I was thinking this morning, I learned recently this is of lower quality than yesterday's, but I learned over the break from my niece this poem, The Duck by Ogden Nash. Have you ever heard this thing? Ogden Nash was kind of a mid-20th century US poet. Wrote funny poems. So it goes, for kids mostly, it goes, behold the duck, it does not cluck, a cluck it lacks, it quacks. It is specially fond of a puddle or pond. When it dines or sups, it bottoms us. And scene. Thank you. Okay. It's going to be important that you're going to, these will get worse and worse. So we should probably stop the clapping now. At some point later in the class, you may feel obliged by habit to clap, but I think it's better if we just quit that habit before it gets ingrained. Okay, so how does this go? Well, let's start with the geometric background. Now you've already, hopefully, in meeting, learning about the geometry used in general relativity, you know, you've encountered another kind of more complicated gauge theory. So here, in this abelian gauge theory, we saw that A mu only had one index. We replaced our partial derivative by a covariant derivative. And the term that we added was rather simple. It only had this one index. But you've probably seen in GR that there you do something rather analogous, but slightly more complicated. You add to the partial derivative a connection which it still carries the index mu, but it also, for a fixed mu, it's also a matrix. It carries two more indices, alpha and beta. And so that's saying that now when you do parallel transport in GR, when you parallel transport a vector, these two indices act like a matrix that rotates the vector as you move it around on the manifold. So what we want is something like that. So let's just see what exactly is the relationship. Also in GR, you have your manifold. You know, you have some n-dimensional manifold, and all that means is that you have some n-dimensional space so that if you zoom in close to any point, it looks just like n-dimensional It looks just like Rn. Now, at any point on the manifold, you have the tangent vectors. Those form a vector space, the tangent vector space at that point. But there's also a tangent vector space at this point and at this point. Okay, there's a tangent vector space living over every point on the manifold. So there's some continuously infinite set of tangent vector spaces. And when you consider all of those things together, that's called the tangent bundle. Okay, it's the collection of all the tangent spaces over the manifold. And the covariant derivative and the Christoffel symbol, or the Levi-Civita connection, are tell you about how to parallel transport vectors around the manifold. So you start with a vector in this vector space, and then you pick a curve that goes over to this point, and these objects tell you about how to move this vector and map it using that curve to a vector in this other tangent space. And then if the manifold is curved, that manifests itself as the fact that if you parallel transport the vector first in this direction and then in this direction, that's different than first parallel transporting it in this direction and then in this direction. You wind up with two different vectors depending on which direction you parallel transport. Okay, so that's all going to be just the same. Those basic geometric ideas are all the same for Yang-Mills theory, with the only difference being that in GR was all about the tangent bundle. The vector space over every point was the tangent vector space. So if we had an n-dimensional manifold, we always had an n-dimensional vector space here. And, you know, it transformed in a particular way under coordinate transformations and so forth. It's a particular vector space. And the curvature that you come, the connection and the covariant derivative and the curvature are all suited to that, the bundle of those vector spaces. So the only difference in Yang-Mills theory is that now we'll again have our space-time manifold, but now we'll imagine that above each point in space, there is another vector space. In addition to the tangent space, there's still the tangent space, of course, but there's another vector space. I wish I had, you know, just some other vector space here, okay? And it will have some other vectors in it. It will not, in general, be n-dimensional. It'll have some different dimension, capital N. Okay, and the Yang-Mills field will now again have two indices, but they won't be indices that lie in the tangent vector space like these do. They will be two indices that lie in some different vector space. I'll write them as maybe lowercase Latin indices, A and B. Okay. So sorry. Oh. Now I've covered that up. What's the best solution? I'll go back over here. Sorry. Okay, so we want, just like we did before, we have this idea that this is going to be some connection that tells us how to parallel transport around the space-time manifold, but instead of parallel transporting vectors in the tangent space, we're parallel transporting vectors between different copies of this other vector space, this other vector bundle. But what is this vector bundle? What does it have to do with the non-abelian symmetry, which got us, which was the whole motivation that started us here, that we wanted to deal with. Well, so the idea is this: that so let's choose. So the idea is that you start to formulate a Yang-Mills theory. You start by choosing the group that you want to be your gauge group, your symmetry group. Okay, so you choose some group G. In this case, again, let's take SUN. Is this more visible if I write in white chalk? Is red chalk visible? No. Okay, so we choose as our gauge group SUN, but then our next step before we write down the theory is we want to choose a representation of SUN in which the matter fields are going to transform. By the matter fields, I'm basically always going to mean all the other fields besides the gauge field. Okay, so in this, so for example, here the matter fields were the scalar field and fermion field that we started with, the other fields in the theory. So I want to choose now a representation for how they transform. So let me remind you what a representation is. Whenever you have a group, a representation of that group is a map from that group to a set of matrices. So that if I have two elements in the group, G1 and G2, and their product is G1 times G2, then I want G1 to map to some matrix R1, and G2 to map to some matrix R2, and G1 times G2 to map to some matrix R12, such that for any pair of, I want a mapping from every element of the group. Okay, I said this in a crappy way, sorry. So I have the elements of the group G. For every element, I'm going to assign it some corresponding matrix. But then I want that matrix to, I want that assignment to respect the multiplication law in the group, okay? So if G1 times G2 is equal to some new element G12, then the assigned matrix here times the assigned matrix here is also equal to the assigned matrix here. Okay, that's what a representation is. And so in particular for SUN, the finite dimensional representations will be maps from this group to some n-dimensional matrices. Okay, so I'll map each group element G in SUN to some let's see, I want some different n. So this is some capital N by N matrix, which is, oh shoot. I meant little n by n matrix. So in other words, I'm trying to emphasize that this n here is distinct from this n, which is the dimension of the representation. And so these guys, these matrices, act on some n component vector. And that vector is this red vector. Okay, this red vector space, my notation is all over the place, I apologize. So I had already used little n over there for the dimension of the manifold, but here it means something different. Here it means the dimension of the representation. Okay, why don't I call that little r? Some r by r matrix, it acts on an r-dimensional vector. And that r-dimensional vector space is exactly the red vector space I drew over here. So the Yang-Mills theory is going to be about the connection and the curvature of this new vector bundle, this r-dimensional vector bundle coming from the representation of our gauge group. Okay, but once we know that, the process of writing down the Lagrangian is very similar to what we did for in the U1 case. So let's just do it quickly to see. So let's let psi A, now our matter fields, instead of just being, before we had a scalar field, which we called phi, it was just a single complex number over each point in space. Okay, but now I want it to be this r-dimensional vector over each point in space. Okay, so I'm going to give it another index here, which runs from 1 to r. Okay, so now it depends on space-time position, but it's also an r component vector above each point in space. And then I'll just often abbreviate that as just phi of x. I won't write the index, but I want you to remember now that this is an r component vector. And so now, as we said a moment ago, this guy is now acted upon by the r times r, by the r by r matrix, matrices which form the representation of SUN. Okay, so now, instead of phi transforming like this, as it did in the U1 case, we want it to transform like this, where this is some r by r matrix acting on this r component vector. Okay, so now as before, if we look at how this guy transforms, well, if U was a constant matrix, if it didn't depend on the space-time position, then this thing would transform to this, but the U would be a constant. It would pull right through here, and we would get this. But now again, because U does depend on because now to make a Yang-Mills theory, again, it's supposed to be a gauge theory, so U is, the symmetry transformation is supposed to depend on the space-time position, so partial mu will act on this guy. Okay, now again, the same trick as before. We want to replace d mu by a covariant derivative. Just as before. And now we want to figure out, again, just as we did before, we want to figure out how does this thing have to transform so that when we consider the covariant derivative of phi, so we wanted the partial derivative of phi to transform into just this term, but we got this extra junk. So now we want this to when it transforms to d mu prime phi prime, we want that to be just the part, just the analog of the part we wanted here. Without the extra junk. And so, okay, so if we expand this out as before, so here I've replaced this guy by partial mu ig a prime, because this is the transformed covariant derivative, and then times the transformed field here. Now we want that to be equal to u times the untransformed expression. Okay, and now as before, we just want to figure out how does a mu have to transform in order for these two sides to be equal. And a little bit of an algebra analogous to the algebra we did before. You can solve for a mu prime. You can solve for a mu prime in that expression. and find that A mu prime is now equal to U A mu U inverse. Okay, before we didn't have these extra U's here, because in the abelian case, this U passes right through A and kills that U. But now things don't commute, so this is so the first term looks like this. And then there's a second term, which is I over the gauge coupling G times partial mu U times U inverse. Okay? So that's the first important thing. The way to make the covariant derivative transform covariantly when the gauge group is no longer commutative, no longer abelian, it should transform like this. And now, if we want to get the formula for the corresponding field strength of this guy, I'll just end with this this point. If we want to get the field strength, well, remember this fact that when we have a curved connection, something you already have met in GR is that when the connection is curved and you parallel transport the vector a little bit this way and then this way, that's different than transporting it a little bit this way and then this way. So that's related to the fact, that's actually equivalent to the fact that when you take now two of these covariant derivatives and you commute them, you're used to the fact that when you take two partial derivatives and commute them, it's zero. If you first applied partial mu and then partial nu to an object and then partial nu and then partial nu, partial mu, those two give the same result. But when we have covariant derivatives, you don't get the same result. So here, if you expand this guy out, a useful exercise is to check, that when you simplify this expression, you get this. I really recommend doing that if you haven't done it. And then a second thing is to, now if we substitute in our expression for the covariant derivative, this expression here, for d mu and d nu, and we expand this thing out, we find that it's equal to I times g times something, which we'll call the field strength, times phi. And this is the exact analog of what you do in GR. In GR, you take the covariant derivatives in GR and you commute them when acting on some vector. They're proportional to something, and that something is nothing but the Riemann curvature tensor acting on so in GR, the way you derive the expression for the Riemann curvature tensor is by this so-called Ricci identity. You take the commutator of the two covariant derivatives, they fail to commute. By how much do they fail to commute? The right-hand side, by how much does it fail to be zero? Well, it's measured by this tensor, R, which is the Riemann curvature tensor. It is the curvature of the connection on the tangent bundle. So here we have the exact analog of the Ricci equation, but now we're looking at the commutator of the covariant derivatives on the this other vector bundle, the gauge bundle. Again, they fail to commute by some amount. This right-hand side fails to be zero by some amount, which is measured by this tensor, which we see is now the curvature of the of this new connection, curvature of the connection on this different bundle, the gauge bundle. And this curvature is also what physicists usually call the field strength of this gauge field. And if you just work out this expression, just like by working out this expression, you get this, you can get this famous expression for the Ricci curvature, for the Riemann curvature in terms of the Christoffel symbols. Here, if you plug in the expression for covariant derivatives in terms of partial plus IgA mu and expand out, you'll get this famous expression for the field strength of the Yang-Mills field in terms of the Yang-Mills gauge field, A mu. So it is partial mu A nu minus partial nu A mu. That so far, this is exactly the same as what the answer was in ordinary electromagnetism in our ordinary U1 gauge theory. But now, when you work out this expression and keep track of the fact that A mu and A nu no longer commute with each other, you find that there's one other term here, which is Ig times the commutator of A mu with A nu. Okay, so very good. Now we've introduced the Yang-Mills gauge field. We know how it transforms. We found its field strength. This thing turns out to transform like nicely, like a nice tensor. So F mu nu now transforms just to U times F mu nu U. Again, you can check that by plugging this transformation law into this formula, and you'll see that this pops out. And so now we can write down the Lagrangian for this gauge field. So it's almost the same as it was before. Before we wrote down minus 1/4 F mu nu, and that was an invariant. That was the Maxwell Lagrangian that worked in U1 gauge theory. Now the only problem here is that F is not invariant. It transforms with U and U inverse. And so if you plug that in here, you'll see, well, here we get a U F U inverse times U F U inverse. So the interior U's cancel, but we end up with an overall U here and a U inverse here. So to get those to cancel, what we do is take the trace of this thing. And the trace is cyclic, so this U pulls around and cancels this U inverse. And so now we have the action for the Yang-Mills generalization of the Maxwell action. We just take this slight generalization of the Maxwell field strength, of the electromagnetic field strength, and we write down the same thing we would as E&M, but we take the trace, and voila, we have a perfectly space-time, an action which is invariant under the space-time symmetries and under the gauge symmetries. And so now, if we go back to our original expression, sorry, this is the last thing, and then I wanted to complete the thought here. Sorry for running over. So back to our original guy. If we just insert the trace here, okay, now that's the action for Yang-Mills theory. This is, let's call this, ordinary Yang-Mills theory, where the Yang-Mills gauge theory couples to a fermion, and scalar Yang-Mills theory, where the Yang-Mills field couples to a scalar field. So the standard model will just be a combination of Lagrangians like that, and then there's one other term to add, which are the Yukawa couplings. The terms that don't involve any derivatives, the Yukawa couplings about how fermions couple to scalars and how scalars couple to themselves. But so these are all the ingredients we need. In the next class, we'll write down the actual Lagrangian for the standard model and begin to think about it. Okay, sorry. Apologies again for running over.